His mind flinched a little when Harry touched it, but not enough that the necroscope's presence was revealed. Robinson's talent was as yet embryonic. And then, then there was Ben Trask. A sad thing. Harry had hoped there'd be no old friends here, but here was Ben. And finally, Paxton. Paxton the mind flea, the previously unreachable itch, a vampire no less than Harry himself, who scorned the blood of others for the secret juices of their minds, their very thoughts. And indeed Paxton was something else. Keen beyond all the call of duty, zealous to a fault, vicious as the crossbow he even now held on Penny Sanderson in the necroscope's bedroom. So that quick as Harry was to withdraw his probe, still he wasn't quick enough, and Paxton knew he was there. The telepath at once narrowed his eyes and quietly, with a shiver in his voice, called downstairs, "He's close! He's coming!" In the spacious front room of the house, which had served mainly as Harry's study, whose French windows looked out over a garden descending in shallow terraces to a high wall and the river bank beyond, Ben Trask and Guy Teal received Paxton's hushed warning and acknowledged it with tight-lipped glances and cramped, edgy movements. Moon and starlight were their only source of illumination, which in itself was a mistake on their part. Their eyes had required to adjust to the darkness, and even now worked inefficiently in the room's gloom. But the necroscope's every sense was already adjusted. The night was his element. It was the same for those upstairs as for Trask and Teal. Their only light was that of the moon, creeping into Harry's bedroom through a window with the curtains thrown back. But downstairs, Teal felt Harry's presence, touched Ben Trask's elbow, and husked, "Paxton's right. He's close. And my God, I suddenly realize what we're doing here. Ben, what if he comes here, right to this room?" "You do nothing," Trask answered gruffly. "You hold that crossbow to him and do nothing. You give me a chance to talk to him is all. But if you don't get the chance, or if you yourself are threatened, then you shoot, and you shoot for real. The heart, is that understood?"
It was.
"Now be quiet, watch and listen."
Outside in the garden, mist crawled through the gate in the wall, where it hung on rusted hinges. Milky tendrils covered the lower terraces and lapped along the paths. And Trask knew well enough what that meant. Harry made a Mobius jump from the riverbank beyond the gate and emerged with his back to the wall of the house, just to one side of the open French windows. He listened and could hear the breathing of the two men in the room, could feel their very heartbeats. One of them was Ben Trask, but Penny wasn't with them. She was upstairs, and so was Paxton.
"Jesus!" Teal panted, the short hairs rising at the back of his neck. "He's here. I know he is. And I've just seen a lot of trouble, a whole load of pain, for one of us."
Trask cocked his SMG. He took two paces out through the French windows and stood ankle-deep in mist, looking this way and that about the night garden. But he failed to look up. He backed into the room and said,
"Trouble? Pain? For me? You? Who for fuck's sake?" "Paxton!" Teal hissed. "For Paxton!"
Trask turned horrified eyes to the ceiling. Paxton, Robinson, and the girl were upstairs. Harry owed Paxton one, maybe several, and that vicious little bastard was holding his woman up there. Trask had worked out, with entirely human logic, that like any ordinary adversary, the necroscope would enter the downstairs rooms first, which was the main reason he'd sent Paxton upstairs, to keep Harry safe for a little while anyway. Long enough that Trask could maybe talk to him and make sure he got whatever breaks was due him. But Harry wasn't any ordinary adversary, and Trask might have guessed he wouldn't work that way. He'd worked his way, which was unique. But Paxton was in charge up there, and Robinson had a bloody flamethrower.
"Upstairs!" Trask gasped. "Let's go, now!"
Harry, too, had decided that it was time. Upside down above the high window of his bedroom, he used the great webbed sucker discs of his hands to cling to the pitted wall of the house, and lowered his head to look in. A cloud scudding over the moon obscured the small shadow which his head cast. He glanced inside for a moment only, then withdrew, but adding together what he saw and the thoughts of those inside, he now had a complete picture, and before anyone or thing could move or do anything to change that picture, he acted. He relaxed his hold on the wall, conjured a door, and fell through it into the bedroom. Robinson knew it at once. "He's here!" the spotter yelped, spinning on his heel, jumping and gyrating, trying to aim the hot nozzle of his flamethrower in every direction at the same time, but seeing and aiming at nothing. Paxton knew it was true. He could actually feel the necroscope's mind touching his own like an oozing slug, as close as that, but inside the room nothing seemed to have changed. And from downstairs the voices of Trask and Teal were hoarse, where the two were running, thundering through the house and up the stairs, shouting their warnings. "Where?" Paxton's voice was a search of terror. "Where is the bastard?" He and Robinson faced each other. Paxton looked down the glowing muzzle of Robinson's flamethrower into the flicker of its pilot light, and Robinson stared at the business end of Paxton's crossbow. They both reached for the light switch. Penny was in the bed, naked, a sheet pulled up over her chin, around her neck, and Harry was under the sheet with her, where he'd materialized. Not knowing what was happening, she felt his arms go around her, felt his huge webbed discs reconstructing themselves into hands once more, and screamed. Paxton read her mind. Robinson finally pinpointed Harry's vast ESP talent. As the room came alive with electric light, both men turned towards the bed and triggered their weapons. But Harry had already conjured a door, directly under himself and the girl, so that they tumbled through it and apparently through the bed itself. As they went, he dragged the bedsheet after them. In the Mobius continuum, Penny opened her eyes, then gasped and screwed them shut again. But now that she knew who had her, it was okay. Harry took her to a safe place, wrapped the sheet around her. "Stay here. Be quiet. Wait." And as she sat down with a breathless bump in the shade of a wind-carved tree on a deserted midday Australian beach, so he returned to the house. He had to go back, for he'd been challenged. Paxton had challenged him, ignoring his warning and challenged him, and Harry's vampire was furious. In an upstairs room in the house outside Bonnyrigg, the necroscope's bed roared up in fire and smoke, with Paxton and Robinson dancing like maniacs around it, trying to damp down the flames, but already they knew that Harry and the girl had escaped. Trask and Teal came crashing through the door, and the latter took one look, turned white, and backed right out of the room again. Trask went after him and grasped his arm.
"What did you see?"
Teal's mouth opened and closed like a fish out of water.
He's coming back again," he finally gasped, "and he's mad as hell."
Trask stuck his head back inside the smoke-filled bedroom.
"Paxton, Robinson, out of there, now!"
"But the house is burning," Robinson yelled.
"That's right," Trask shouted back. "And all the way to the ground. We'll torch it downstairs, heavily, every room. Raise the place. It's one refuge he won't be able to use again."
And to himself, "Sorry, Harry, but that's the way it is." Except he wasn't entirely to himself, for the necroscope was listening too, listening with his mind, and watching with his scarlet eyes from across the river, where a minute later he heard the gouting roar of the flamethrower and saw the fires spreading through all the downstairs rooms. And,
"My place," Harry thought, "and there it goes in flames. This is the end of it. There's nothing to keep me here now."
In Harry's downstairs study, Paxton turned on Trask and his face was livid.
"Just what is it you're trying to do?"
he demanded.
"You know he won't come into a burning house. Teal says Keogh wants me, and Robinson reckons he's close, but you're holding him off. He has to come to us before we can kill the bastard. Or maybe that's it. Maybe you don't want him killed, right?"
Trask grabbed him by the front of his jacket and almost lifted him off his feet.
"You shithead!"
He dragged him into the garden, out of the blazing room.
"You scumbag! No, I don't want Harry killed, for he was my friend. Still, I'd do it if I had to. But that's okay, for in fact I don't think we can kill him. Not you, or me, or any army like us. You ask why I'm warning you off? For you, Paxton, for you.
For me?
The other struggled free, loaded his crossbow.
Damn right, Trask snarled. For while you can't kill Harry Keogh, you better fucking believe he can kill you.
The downstairs rooms of Harry's house were a red and yellow inferno now, and the smoke had started to pour from the upper windows and ancient gables. In the garden, as the glass in the French windows surrendered to the heat and began to shatter, the four E-Branch agents backed away. Paxton, suddenly anxious, stared this way and that in the glare and flicker of the firelight, and held his crossbow close to his chest. The high garden walls seemed to frown at him, and he stumbled as his shuffling feet missed a step to send him reeling down a path into the knee-deep mist of the lower terraces. That eerie sentient mist, out of which Harry Keogh rose like a ghost from its tomb, with his hellish orbs more than reflecting the destruction of his house.
No!
Paxton's eyes stood out in the parchment of his face as the necroscope towered over him, and his inarticulate gurgle of a cry caused the other agents to turn from watching the burning house towards him in his extremity of terror. What they saw was this. Paxton in the grip of something which was only half or less than half human. They saw Paxton, but only as a detail of the main scene whose utter horror seemed to sear itself into their retinas, and in the minds of the three, one thought was universally uppermost, that they were here as volunteers, come to kill this, an act which must surely qualify them as the bravest and most lunatic heroes of all time. The lower half of Harry's figure was mist-shrouded, visible only as a vague outline in the opaque milky swirl, but the rest of him was all too visible. He was wearing an entirely ordinary suit of dark, ill-fitting clothes, which seemed two sizes too small for him, so that his upper torso sprouted from the trousers to form a blunt wedge. Framed by his jacket, which was held together at the front barely by one straining button, the wedged-shaped bulk of Harry's ribcage was massively muscular. His white, open-necked shirt had burst open down the front, revealing the ripple of his muscle-sheathed ribs and the deep, powerful throb of his chest. The shirt's collar stuck out now from Harry's jacket like a crumpled frill made insubstantial by the corded bulk of his leaden neck. His flesh was a sullen grey, dappled lurid orange and sick yellow by leaping fire and gleaming moonlight. But there was scarlet there too, leaking from the hole in his jacket and splashed diagonally across his straining shirt. He towered all of 15 inches taller than Paxton, whose cringing form he quite literally dwarfed. And his face! That was the absolute embodiment of a waking nightmare. Ben Trask gawped at him in utter disbelief and thought,
"Oh my God! God, I thought I could maybe talk to that!"
"Oh, but you can still talk to me, Ben,"
the necroscope told him. Trask's first personal experience in the use of telepathy, made possible through the sheer power of Harry's probe.
"It's just that where Paxton's concerned, I may not be willing to listen, that's all."
Teal was gibbering, trying desperately to find strength to lift and aim his crossbow, and failing. His talent, a generally untrustworthy ability to read something of the future, was conjuring all sorts of monstrous events in his mind's eye, piling them up so thick and fast that he was utterly unnerved. It was his proximity to Harry, of course. Robinson was similarly stricken. This close to the true metaphysical power, his own small talent was reacting like iron filings whirled in a strong magnetic field. But in any case, he couldn't use his terrible weapon, not without burning Paxton too. Trask was on his own, the only capable one among them, and now he raised and aimed his SMG at Harry, where he held Paxton up before him like a rag doll. Paxton dangling there in midair, staring gawp-jawed and bulged-eyed in the necroscope's unbelievable face, knowing he was only inches from the gates of hell. That close, yes, for he was the mind flea. He was the unbearable, unscratchable itch, or he had been until now. Harry looked at him through halogen Halloween eyes, which seemed to drip sulphur, looked at him and grinned. A grin, was that what it was? In an alien vampire world called Starside on the other side of the Mobius Continuum. There, at least, it might be called a grin, but here it was the rabid, slavering grimace of a great wolf. Here it was the teeth visibly elongated, curving up and out of gleaming gristle-jaw ridges to shear through gums, which spurted splashes of hot ruby blood. Here it was a gradual inclination of a monstrous head through several degrees to an almost curiously inquiring angle, the way you might look at a mischievous pet. And having looked, it was a writhing of scarlet lips and flattening a convoluted snout, the beginning of a slow yawning of man-trap jaws to tut-tut and even chastise the disobedient lapdog, and perhaps to punish it. That face, that mouth, that crimson cavern of stalactite, stalagmite teeth, jagged as shards of white broken glass. What? The gates of hell? All of that, and worse. When Harry had grabbed Paxton and lifted him off his feet, he'd knocked the telepath's crossbow from his grasp and thrown it down. Unarmed, Paxton was a piece of candy, a sweetmeat, a coconut flake. He was something to munch on. Why, Harry could bite his face off if he wished it. And suddenly Trask thought, maybe he does. Maybe he will. Harry, Trask shouted, don't. The necroscope slowly closed his jaws, looked up. He glared at Trask across the mystic garden in the ruddy illumination of the burning house. At Ben Trask, once a friend with whom he'd stood side by side against just such a creature as he had now become. And Trask, way-faced, staring back, thinking, for fuck's sake, don't, Harry.
Would you shoot me, Ben?
You know I would. I wouldn't want to, even now. But I have to. It's you or the world, don't you see? I don't want to see my world die screaming, then laugh and crawl right back out of its grave. But if you let him go, Paxton, I mean, if you let him live, then I'd be ready to believe you'd let us all live.
Your world is safe, Ben. I'm not staying here.
Starside? Harry's mental shrug.
There's nowhere else.
Trask looked down the sights of his SMG. He could shoot at Harry's mist-wreathed legs and maybe chop him down, or he could aim at the necroscope's head and upper body and try not to hit Paxton in the bargain. But he was a good shot and unlikely to miss his target. Or he could simply take Harry's word for it, that he was going away from here, and the world had nothing to fear from him. Except, looking at him now, who could believe that? Harry read these things in Trask's mind, and tried to make it easier for him. He put Paxton down, which was anything but easy for the necroscope. He had to fight the thing inside him, and fight hard, but he did it. And speaking out loud, or rather grunting in the deep bass monotone of the Vampiri, he asked,
how's this, Ben?
Trask gasped his relief. It's good, Harry, it's good. But even answering, he was aware, out of the corner of his eye, of Teal and Robinson unfreezing and lining up their weapons. Hold it, you two, he shouted. Harry shot a blood-tinged glance at Teal, which sufficed to send him staggering back and tuned into Robinson's mind to advise him.
Better listen to Trask, son. Try to fry me on Earth and I'll fry you in hell.
Trask put his SMG on safe and tossed it aside. The war's over, Harry, he said. But Paxton, lying in the mist where Harry had dropped him, squeezed the trigger of his regained crossbow and cried,
oh no, it fucking isn't.
Moments earlier, the necroscope had picked up the message from Paxton's mind that a deadly hardwood bolt was about to come winging its way. Almost instinctively, he had conjured a Mobius door, and now, with the deceptively sinuous grace of the Vampiri, he stepped or flowed backwards into it. To the four espers, it seemed that he had simply ceased to be. Paxton's bolt shot forward into the misty swirl of Harry's vacuum and was eaten up by it, leaving the telepath panting.
I got him! I'm sure I got the bastard! I couldn't miss!
Laughing, however shakily, he got to his feet, and the mist, where it had closed on the necroscope, opened up again, And his clotted, gurgling, disembodied voice came out of it, saying,
"How sorry I am to have to disappoint you."
Shit,
Trask thought, snatching a breath of hot, smoky air, as a huge grey hand with nails like rust-scabbed fish hooks reached out of empty space, closed over Paxton's head, and dragged him, shrieking, out of the garden and right out of this universe. And Harry Keogh's monstrous voice left hanging in the air, saying,
"Ben, I'm afraid I just have to do this."
In the Mobius Continuum, Harry hurled Paxton away from him and heard his scream dwindling into conjectural distances. He should leave him there, let him spin on his own axis, flailing across parallel infinities forever, shrieking and sobbing and, if his heart should burst, finally dying a raving madman. But that would be to pollute this mystical place. There had to be a better way, a more reasonable punishment than that. He sped after him, caught and steadied him, and drew him close. And there in the Mobius Continuum, whose nature even Harry was only just beginning to suspect and understand, where even the smallest thought was weight, he said to him,
"Paxton, you are a miserable creature."
"Get away from me! Get the fuck away from me!"
Harry sucked his teeth, which, as his blood began to cool, were halfway to normal again.
"And you a telepath. You don't need to shout in the Mobius Continuum, mind flea. Just thinking it is enough."
And in that selfsame moment, Harry knew what he must do. Of course, Paxton the mind flea, the mental vampire who lived on thoughts of others rather than their blood. The thought thief, the unscratchable itch. How many victims had felt his bite? E-Branch was full of them, and how many more didn't even know, were equipped to know, that he'd ever been in their minds in the first place? Or maybe not a flea, maybe a mosquito. But in any case, a harmful parasite with a painful, irritating sting. It was high time someone drew that sting, and the necroscope knew just exactly how to do it. He entered Paxton's dazed, terrified mind to search for and discover the telepathic mechanism which was the source of the man's talent. It was something Paxton had been born with, and there was no switching it off, but it could be shielded, buried in psychic lead like a rogue reactor, until it melted down or burned itself out, trying to break free. Which was precisely what the necroscope did. He wrapped Paxton's talent in essence of Vampiri mind smog, smothered it in a blanket of ESP opaqueness, mothballed it into ephemeral and yet almost unbreakable threads of what ordinary people term the privacy of their own minds. Except that in Paxton's case, that privacy would be his prison. And when Harry was done with him, he delivered Paxton back to the garden of the burning house, where the men from E-Branch had moved down to the river wall, away from the heat of the conflagration. Against a backdrop of roaring, gouting gold and crimson fire, Harry emerged from the Mobius Continuum and tossed a snivelling Paxton into Ben Trask's arms. The telepath at once collapsed in tears, sank raggedly to his knees, and hugged Trask's legs. Looking down at him, Trask was aghast. "What have you done to him?"
"Neutered him,"
said Harry.
"What?"
Harry shook his head.
"Not his balls, his telepathy. Mental emasculation. He's raped his last mind. And where the branch is concerned, I've done you my last favour."
"Harry?"
"Look after yourself, Ben."
"Harry, wait!"
But the necroscope was no longer there. He stood off for long moments along the river and watched the old house burn. What was it Father Faithor had called his castle, Inkavati, when finally that morbid pile had been reduced to rubble? His last vestige on earth? Well, and this obsolete old house had been Harry's last vestige. In this world, anyway. On a beach of gleaming white sand on the other side of the world, Penny had fashioned a bikini for herself from strips of Harry's bedsheet. Now walking at the rim of the ocean, she picked up and examined exotic shells where they littered the tide's reach. Strangely, because she usually tanned without difficulty, and also because her, as yet innocent, mind hadn't recognized the significance of it, she found the sun spiteful. Her exposed skin was already blotched and rapidly turning red. To cool herself, she kneeled in the shallows of a tidal pool and let the sea lave her. Which was when Harry returned and called out to her from the shade of the wind-blasted tree. She looked up and saw him, and felt the power of his magnetism stronger than ever before. It was love, and it was much more than love. He need only command it, and there was nothing she wouldn't do for him. She was entirely enthralled. Taking a magnificent conch with her, she ran to him and saw how different he looked, different and yet the same. Before returning to her, the necroscope had stopped off somewhere to pick up a wide-brimmed black hat and a long black overcoat. Weird gear, Penny thought, for a beach in the heat of the midday sun. Now he reminded her of the grim-faced bounty hunter or undertaker in how many of those old spaghetti westerns, except they hadn't worn dark-tinted glasses. Where the tree gave its maximum shade, Harry eased off his coat and displayed evidence of his wounds. Great mats of blood congealed into rusty scabs which crusted his tatters and glued them to him. Feeling his hurt, indeed feeling more of it than he felt, Penny unwrapped the strip of soaked cotton sheet from her breasts and dampened the necroscope's blooded area with brine. And then she was able to peel the soiled rags from his now entirely human body. His human-looking body, anyway. From the front, the bullet hole in Harry's right shoulder didn't look too bad, but from the back it was awful. A chunk of flesh the size of a child's clenched fist had been blown right out of him, and its rim at the top had been ripped by Johnny Found's hook. But amazingly, to Penny, if not to the necroscope himself, the wound was already healing. New skin was forming around the crater, where flesh and bone had been blasted away, and while the pulp within gleamed red as meat on a butcher's block, still it had almost stopped bleeding. "It's healing now," Harry grunted. "If you just sat there and watched it, you'd see it closing up. Another day, two almost, and there'll be only a scar. Another week, and even the reconstructed bone will have stopped aching." Fascinated, drawn to him irresistibly, she clutched his shoulders and turned her lithe, lovely body this way and that, brushing her breasts against the gaping hole in his back. Done on impulse, her eroticism caused the necroscope a little pain and gave him a lot of pleasure. Looking over his shoulder, he saw the brown of her nipples stained red by blood fresh from his body. But in the next moment, astonished by the strength of her own sensuality, Penny said, I don't quite know why I did that. "I do," he growled, taking her there on the sand, and in turn being taken, again and again through the long hot afternoon. It was love and lust, and what lovers have done since the beginning of time. But it was other than that, more than that. It was an initiation of sorts, for Harry as much as for Penny, and it proved beyond a doubt how utterly inexhaustible are the Vampiri and their thralls. Later, she woke up feeling chilly, saw Harry sitting there with her shell in his lap. His face was gaunt, almost pained. The sun setting over the rolling ocean highlighted the rims of hollows in his face like shallow craters in a moonscape. Squinting her eyes until he was a little more than a dark silhouette, Penny tried to make this newly perceived Harry less stark. The two distinct lines melted a little and softened his face, but the pain was still there. Then, when he felt her eyes on him, the mood was broken, and when she sat up shivering, he draped her with his coat. "Picking the shell up," she said. "It's beautiful, isn't it?" He gave her a strange look. "It's a dead thing, Penny." "Is that all you see? Death?" He shook his head. "No. I feel it, too. I'm the necroscope."
"You feel that the shell is dead?"
He nodded. "And how the creature it housed died. Well, not feel it, exactly. I experience it. No, not that either." He shrugged and sighed.
"I just know."
He looked at the conch again, and the sun struck mother of pearl from its iridescent rim.
It isn't pretty.
He shook his head.
It's ugly.
Do you see that tiny hole towards the pointed end? She nodded.
That's what killed it. Another snail, smaller but deadly to it, bored into it and sucked out its life.
A vampire, yes. There are millions of us. And she saw him give a shudder. She put the shell aside.
That's a horrid story, Harry.
It's also a true one.
How can you know that?
His voice was harsher now.
Because I'm the necroscope. Because dead things talk to me. All dead things. And if they haven't the mind for it, then they convey it to me. And your pretty bloody shell? It conveys the slow grind of its killer, eating into its whirl, the penetration of its probe, and the dully burning seep of its fluids being drained off. Pretty? It's a corpse, Penny. A cadaver.
He stood up and scuffed listlessly at the sand, and she said,
Has it always been like that? For you, I mean?
No. He shook his head. But it is now. My vampire is growing. As he grows sharper, so he hones my talents. There was a time when I could only talk to dead people, or rather to creatures I could understand. Dogs go on after death just like we do. Do you know that? But now, again his shrug, if they were alive once but now are dead, I can feel them, and I feel more and more of them all the time. He kicked at the sand again. You see this beach? The very sand sighs and whispers and moans. 1,000,000,000 corpses broken up by time and the tides.
All of that life wasted, and none of it ready or willing to lie quiet and still. And every dead thing wanting to know.
Why did I die? Why did I die?
But it has to be that way,
she gasped, frightened by his tone.
It always has been. Without death, what would be the point of life? If we had forever, we wouldn't strive to do anything, because everything would be possible.
In this world, he took her shoulders, there's life and there's death. But I know another world where there's a state between the two.
And as it grew dark, he told her all about Starside. When he was done, she shivered to the inevitability of it and asked,
When should we go there?
Soon, he told her.
We can't stay here. I know that place is bound to frighten me.
Do my eyes frighten you?
They were like small lamps in his face. She smiled.
No, because I know they're your eyes.
But they frightened others.
Because they don't know you.
On Starside, I'll build an aerie,
Harry told her, where your eyes will be as red as mine.
Will they?
She seemed almost eager.
Oh, yes, Harry told her.
And to himself,
You may be sure of it, you poor darling child. For even here and now, as early and unanticipated as this, he could detect the faintest scarlet flush in them.
While she slept in his arms, Harry sat and made plans. They weren't much, just something to do. They kept him from thinking too deeply about his and Penny's imminent departure, its possible perils, about his inevitability. For it was inevitable, as was the drone of the helicopter whose searchlights came sweeping along the beach from the east. Harry had thought they'd be safe here for, a long time, but as he reached out and touched the minds of the people in the droning dragonfly aeroplane, he saw that he'd been wrong. They were espers. The branch, he said, perhaps bitterly, waking Penny up and forming Mobius equations in his mind.
What even here?
She mumbled as he shifted her across the continent to a clothing store in Sydney.
Even here, there, yes, he said. Indeed, anywhere. Their locators will find me no matter where I go. They'll alert their contacts worldwide. Espers and bounty hunters will track and trap and eventually burn us. We can't fight a whole world. And even if I could, I don't want to. Because to fight is to surrender to the thing inside me. And I'd prefer to be just me.
For as long as possible, anyway. But tonight we'll lead them all a dance, right? For tomorrow we die.
Die?
We'll be dead to this world anyway, he said. They chose expensive clothes willy-nilly and an expensive leather suitcase in which to pack them. Then, as the store's alarms began to clamour, they moved on. It had been 9 p.m. local time when they left the beach. It was 11:30 in the store they robbed. Moving east, they got dressed on another beach, Long Beach, at 5 a.m. in the first light of dawn, and started a champagne breakfast in New York a little after 8 a.m., and all in the space of 30 or so minutes. Penny ate her steak barbecued, medium rare. Harry's was so rare it dripped blood, just the way he'd ordered it. They drank 3 bottles of champagne, then presented with the bill the necroscope laughed, snatched Penny into his lap, and tilted his chair over backwards, and the pair of them out of this world into the Möbius continuum. Minutes later, at 10:30 p.m. local time, and some 3,500 miles north of where they started out, they robbed the innermost security vaults of the Bank of Hong Kong, and by midnight they'd lost $1 million Hong Kong dollars on the gaming tables in Macau. A few minutes later, at 6:30 in the evening, local, still ordering and drinking champagne, Harry bundled an entirely tipsy Penny into a hotel bed in Nicosia and left her there to sleep it off. She dripped pearls and diamonds, and her skin smelled of a fine haze of alcohol. Most women, were they truthful, would give an entire world for the things she had seen and done and experienced in the last half day of her life. So had Penny given a world. That's why Harry had arranged and executed it. Their binge had taken a little over 3 hours. The locators at E-Branch HQ in London and others in Moscow were quite dizzy. But the necroscope knew that Penny was, as yet, too weak a source for them to track as a single entity. On her own, they probably wouldn't be able to find her. Even if they could, he doubted if they'd have a man in Cyprus. She'd be safe there, for a little while anyway. And now it was time he made their starside reservations.
Part 4, Chapter 1. Feithor, Zek, Perchosk. In the Möbius continuum, Harry opened a future time door and went looking for Feithor Ferenczi. Feithor was long dead and gone, and had been incorporeal, which is to say bodiless, for a very long time. So long that by now he was probably mindless too. But there were things of great importance which the necroscope wanted to ask him. About his disease, and how he'd come by it. Maybe even about how he could cure it, though that possibility seemed almost as remote as Feithor himself. Möbius time was awesome as ever. Before launching himself down the ever-expanding time stream, Harry paused, framed in the doorway, and looked out on humanity as few flesh and blood men had ever seen it, and only then on his authority. He saw it as blue light, the near-neon blue of all human life, rushing out and away with an interminable sigh, an orchestrated angelic into forever and ever. But the sigh was all in his mind. Indeed, he knew it was his mind sighing, for time is quite silent. Which was just as well, for if all the sound in all the years of all the life he witnessed had been present, then it would have been an utterly unbearable cacophony. He stood or floated in the metaphysical doorway and gazed on all those lines of blue light streaming out and away, the myriad lifelines of the human race, and thought, it's like a blue star gone nova, and these are its atoms fleeing for their lives. And he knew that indeed every dazzling line was a life, which he could trace from birth to death across the trackless heavens of Möbius time. For even now, his own lifeline unwound out of him, like a thread unwinding from a bobbin to cross the threshold and shoot away into the future. Except where the rest were pure blue, his thread carried a strong crimson taint. As for Feithor's line, if it existed at all, it would be pure, impure, scarlet. But it didn't, for Faithor's life was over. No life now for that ancient, once undead thing, but true death, where he sped on and on beyond the bounds of being, all thanks, or whatever, to Harry Keogh. Bodiless, yes, the old vampire, but still the necroscope knew how to track him, for in the Mobius continuum thoughts have weight, and, like time itself, go on forever. Faithor? Harry called out, sending a probe lancing ahead as he launched himself down the time stream. I'd like to pay you a visit, if you're in the mood for it.
Oh?
The answer came back at once, and then, astonishingly, a chuckle, one of Faithor's most dark, most devious chuckles.
A meeting of two old fiends, eh? And is it visiting day? Well, and why not? But truth to tell, I've been expecting you.
You have? Harry caught up with Faithor's spirit, with the memory, the mind which was all that remained of him.
Oh, yes. For who else would know the answer if not me, eh?
The answer? But Harry knew well enough what he meant. The answer, the solution to his problem, assuming such a solution existed.
Come, come.
Faithor tut-tutted.
Am I naive? Call me what you will, Harry, but never that.
And now he gave a dead-speak nod and looked the necroscope over.
Well, well. But you know, you never failed to amaze me. I mean, so many talents. And now this faster-than-life travel. Why, look, you've even outstripped yourself.
Even as Faithor spoke, Harry's lifeline gave a wriggle, a shudder, and split down the middle. Half of the line bent back a little on itself and shot off at right angles to the necroscope's line of travel, shortly to disappear in a brilliant burst of red and blue fire. But the other half, like a comet with Harry himself for its nucleus, sped on as before and kept pace with Faithor. Harry had been expecting some such. The phenomenon he'd just witnessed, which in fact had been his departure point to Starside, was in the probable future. But this was Mobius time, which is to say speculative time, and nothing was for certain. It was the reason why reading the future was so very hit and miss, and if in the real world anything contrary should happen to him between now and then, his departure simply wouldn't happen, or possibly not. In other words, and despite the fact that he'd seen it, it was only something which might happen.
But probably,
said Faithor, and again he chuckled.
So, they're driving you out, eh?
Harry shrugged. No, I'm going of my own free will.
Because if you stay, they'll hunt you down and destroy you.
Because I will it, Harry repeated.
You brought yourself into prominence,
said Faithor,
and they looked at you closely. Now they know you for what you are. All of these years you've been their hero, and now you're their worst nightmare come true. And so it's back to Starside. Well, good luck to you, but mind you look out for that son of yours. Why, the last time you were there he crippled you.
Before continuing their conversation, Harry very carefully shielded his mind. Only show Faithor the tiniest crack in the door and he'd be in, not only to spy on the necroscope's most secret thoughts, but to lodge himself in his mind as a permanent tenant. It was the ancient vampire's one chance, his very last chance, for any sort of continuity other than this empty, endless speeding into the future. And so when Harry was satisfied that he'd made himself impregnable, yes, my son crippled me, he agreed, robbed me of my deadspeak, denied me access to the Mobius Continuum. It was easy for him then, because I was only a man, but now, as you see, I am Vampiri.
You go back to do battle with him?
Faithor hissed.
Your own son?
If that's the only way, Harry shrugged again, mainly to disguise his lie. But it doesn't have to be a fight. Starside is a big place, even bigger now that the Vampiri are dead or fled. Faithor mused.
So you'll return to Starside, build yourself an airy there, and if necessary, do battle with your son for a piece of his territory. Is that it?
Possibly.
So why have you come to see me? What have I to do with it? If this is your plan, then go do it.
For long moments, Harry was silent. Finally, he answered, "But it was my thought that you might like to come with me." Faithor's gasp, the ensuing silence, was of stunned disbelief, until eventually...
"That I might like?"
"To come with me," Harry said again. "But..."
"No,"
said Faithor in a while, and Harry sensed the unbodied shake of his head.
"I can't credit this. It is... can only be a trick. You, who once fought so long and hard to keep me out, now invite me in? To be one with you in your new vampiric mind, body, and..."
"Don't say soul," said Harry, "as you have it wrong."
"Eh?"
Faithor was at once on his guard.
"But how can I have it wrong? To go with you from this hellish new place into Starside is out of the question, unless it is as part of you. Here I am nothing. But if of your own free will you're now inviting my mind into yours..."
"Initially, yes," said Harry. "But this time you must agree to move out when I desire it, and without a struggle. Without that I must use trickery, as last time." Faithor was flabbergasted.
"Move out to where?"
"Into the mind and body of some lesser man, some traveller king or such in Starside." And finally Faithor understood, or thought he did, and his deadspeak thoughts turned sour as vinegar.
"And so you are unworthy after all," he said then, "and have been from the start. I used to lie in the earth in my place in Ploiesti, and think, the Necroscope can have it all, everything, the world. Thibor was a ruffian, unworthy, but not so Harry. Janus was the scummy froth of my loins, beside which Harry has the consistency and purity, or if not that, then at least the homogeneity of cream. I shall make Harry my third and last son. Yes, these were my thoughts, of which you were unworthy."
"How come?" said Harry. "I mean, why do you insult me?"
"What?"
Astonishment, disbelief.
"Surely you mean, why do I sorrow? But you could have been, could still be, the most powerful creature of all time. The master vampire, the great plague bearer. Because I, Faithor Ferenczi, willed it. You are Vampiri. You have admitted as much yourself, and yet now you would throw it all away? Does it mean nothing to you to be Vampiri? What of the passion, the power, the glory?"
"What of me?" Harry answered. "The real me, before my adulteration."
"The new you is greater."
Harry shook his head. "I don't resent the greatness. Only that it was not on my terms. But now I am offering you terms, and no more time to waste. Can you help me, or can't you?"
"Cards on the table, then," said Faithor. "You will take me into your mind, transfer or transport me to Starside, which after all is or should have been my natural place, and there pass me on to some other to guide him as I would have guided you. In return for which, you desire to know if there's a way you may rid yourself of the thing growing within you. Now do I have it right?"
"And if there is a way," Harry qualified the deal, "you'll describe it in detail, a fool's guide, so that I may be my own man again."
"Following which, you'll return to your own world, leaving me embodied once more in Starside?"
"That's the plan."
"And if there is no way to free you?"
Harry shrugged. "A deal is a deal. You'll be a power on Starside anyway, as stated, eventually to become your rival."
"And your son's rival?"
Yet again the Necroscope shrugged. "Like I said, with the old Vampiri dead or fled, Starside is a big place." Faithor was cautious.
"It seems to me that whichever way it goes, still I get the best of this bargain. Now why should you be so good to me,
"Maybe it's like you said," Harry told him, "a meeting of two old friends."
Fiends?
Faithor corrected him. As you will, except I'm an unwilling fiend, and despite the fact that you're the engineer of my current fix, still I can't forget that in the past you've put yourself out to do me one or two favours, even though all of them, a little sourly, as I've since come to realise, were to your ultimate benefit. Still, it seems I've grown accustomed to you. I understand you now. You played the game according to your own rules. That's all. Vampiri rules. Also, I'm full of human compassion. I can't help it, and I have to admit my conscience has been bothering me. About you, stuck here in the Mobius time. About my leaving you here. And finally, well, you said it yourself. If there is a cure to my complaint, who'd know it better than you? Which is the number one reason I'm here and doesn't leave me with much choice. He was very convincing.
Very well, said Faithor,
as Harry had supposed he would.
You have a deal. Now take me into your mind.
When you have told me what I want to know.
Whether or not you may rid yourself of your vampire?
A little more than that.
Oh.
Where it came from. How it got into me in the first place.
You haven't thought it out for yourself.
It was the toadstools, right? Faithor's deadspeak nod.
Yes.
And the toadstools were you?
Yes. They were spawned of my fats, festering in the earth where I'd burned and melted down. An ichor, an essence simmering there, waiting. Then, when the brew was ripe, I willed the fungi up into the light, but not until I knew you'd been there to receive them.
And you were in them?
As you well know, for through them I came to you. But you cast me out.
And these fungi, are they a natural part of the Vampiri chain? Part of the overall life cycle?
I don't know.
Faithor seemed at a genuine loss.
There was no one to instruct me in such mysteries. Old Belos Feroxis might have known, might even have passed such knowledge down to my father. But if so, then Veldemar Ferenczig never told me. I only knew that the spores were in me, in the fats of my body, and that I could will them into growth. But don't ask me how I knew. How does a dog know how to bark?
And the spores were your very last vestiges?
Yes.
Could it be that such toadstools grow in the vampire swamps on Starside? It seems logical to me, since these swamps are the source of vampire infestation. Faithor sighed his impatience.
But I've never even seen the vampire swamps on Starside, though I hope to, and soon. And then, let me into your mind.
Can I be rid of my vampire?
Do we still have a deal, however I may answer?
So long as you answer true.
No. You are stuck with your vampire forever.
Harry wasn't hard hit. He had supposed it would be so, even with regard to the very question or idea or thought of curing himself. His will was already weakening. Probably had been for some time, for he was learning what it was to be a Vampiri, and if his right hand didn't like it, then his left hand did. The dark side of men has always been their stronger side. And what of women? The Lady Karen's cure had been her destruction. In his mind, like an echo, the necroscope heard once more Faithor's answer.
You are stuck with your vampire forever.
And he thought, so be it. And, to Faithor, said, then farewell. He began to decelerate, leaving the astonished vampire to speed on ahead as before. As the gap rapidly widened, Faithor desperately called back.
What? But you said...
I lied, Harry cut him off.
What? You? A liar?
Faithor couldn't accept it.
But that's not like you at all.
No, Harry answered grimly. But it is like the thing inside me. It is like my vampire. For it's part of you, Faithor. It's part of you.
Wait!
Faithor cried out in his extremity.
You can be rid of it. It's true. You really can.
"And that is the part," said Harry, transferring out of time and back into the Mobius continuum. "The lying part." And in Mobius' time, Faethor was left to shriek and gibber, but faintly now and fading, like the slithering whispers of winter's crumbling leaves, whirled forever in the winds of eternity. Harry went to see Jazz and Zek on the island of Zakynthos in the Ionian. They had a villa in the trees, overlooking the sea and hidden well away from the holidaymakers in Porto Zorro on the northeast coast. It was 8 in the evening when he materialized close to the house. He put out a probe and saw that Zek was on her own, but guessed that Jazz wouldn't mind his wife speaking for both of them. First, he reached out for her telepathically, and the way she answered him, unafraid, it was as if she expected him. "For a day or two," she said, after inviting him in, when he'd explained what he was doing. "But of course she'll be okay here, the poor girl." "Not so poor," he was prompted to answer, almost defensively. "Because she doesn't really understand it. She won't fight it as hard as I have. And before she knows it, she'll be Vampiri."
"But Starside, how will you live there? I mean, do you intend to..."
Zek gave up. She was, after all, talking to a vampire. She knew that behind those dark lenses his eyes were fire, knew too how easily she could be burned by them. But if she feared him, it didn't show, and Harry liked her for that. He always had liked her. "We'll do what we have to do," he answered. "My son found a way to survive."
"The way I see it," she said, with an almost unnoticeable shudder, "blood is a powerful addiction."
"The most powerful," he told her. "It's why we have to go." Zek didn't want to push it, but felt she must. Her female curiosity.
"Because you love your fellow man? And can't trust yourself?"
He shrugged and offered her a wry smile. "Because E-Branch can't trust me." But his half-smile swiftly faded. "Who knows? Maybe they're right not to." And after long moments of silence, he added, "What about Jazz?" She looked at him and lifted an eyebrow, as if to say, "Do you really need to ask?"
"Jazz doesn't forget his friends, Harry. But for you, we were long since dead on Starside, and in this world. But for you, the Firenze's son, Janos, would still be alive and festering. Anyway, Jazz is in Athens seeking dual nationality."
"When can I bring Penny here?"
"That's up to you. Now, if you wish."
Harry gathered Penny up from her bed in the Nicosia Hotel, without even waking her. And moments later, Zek saw how gentle he laid her between cool sheets in the guest bedroom of this, her new temporary refuge. And she nodded to herself, certain now that if anyone was able to look after this girl, on Starside or anywhere else, then it would be the Necroscope.
"And what now, Harry?" she queried,
serving coffee sweetened with Metaxa brandy on her balcony where it jutted over the cliffs and the moonlit sea.
"Now, Perchosk,"
he answered simply. But halfway down his cup, he fell asleep in his chair. It was a measure of his trust that he felt he could just rest here, and it was a measure of Zek Foner's that she didn't go and fetch her spear gun and silver harpoon and try to kill him there and then, and Penny after him. But she didn't. But even Zek couldn't feel that safe. Before retiring, she called for Wolf, a real wolf, born on Starside. And when he came from the dark, scented cover of the Mediterranean pines, stationed him at her door, and,
"Wake me if they should move," she told him.
At midnight, Harry woke up and went to Perchosk in the USSR's Uralsky Krabet. Zek watched him go and wished him luck. In the Urals, it was 3:30 in the morning, and in the depths of the Perchosk project, Viktor Luchov was asleep and nightmaring. He always would nightmare, as long as they kept him here. But now, since British E-Branch's warning, the nightmares were much worse. What exactly did that warning consist of? A vague, shadowy Harry Keogh inquired of him in his dream. "No, don't tell me. Let me take a shot at it, have a go at guessing it. It had to do with me, right?" Luchov, the project director, didn't know where Harry had come from, but suddenly he was there, pacing the disc's bolted metal plates with him in the glare of the sphere gate arm in arm like old friends in the harrowing heart of Perchask, in the very roots of the mountains. And finally he answered,
"What that you ask? Did it have to do with you? But you sell yourself short, Harry. Why, you were all of it."
"They told you about me?"
"Your E-branch, yes. I mean, not specifically. They told me. They did not warn me, but they did warn the new man in charge of our own espionage group, who, of course, passed it on to me, except I am not sure I should be repeating it to you."
"Not even in a dream?"
"Dream?"
Luchov shuddered, his subconscious mind briefly, however unwillingly, returning to the horror of what had gone before. He considered that for a moment, and in the next recoiled from it as if scalded.
"My God, but the whole monstrous business was a nightmare. In fact, and for all that you scared me witless, you were one of the few human things about it."
"Human, yes," said Harry, nodding. "But that was then, and this is now." Luchov disengaged his arm and moved a little apart, then turned and looked at the necroscope, stared hard, curiously, even fearfully at him, as if to bring him into definition. But Harry's outline was fuzzy. He wouldn't come into focus. Against the glare of the gate, where its dome came up through the disc, he was a silhouette whose rim was punctuated and perforated with brilliant lances of white light.
"They say that you... that you're...